porch. "Thanks for coming by to see her," I said. "You don't have to thank me," Kayla said. "I do it because I want to. It just so happens that I love your grandmother. I love her tremendously. She's one of my guiding lights, my mentor. Has been for years." Then Kayla leaned in very quickly, and she kissed me. She held the kiss for a few seconds. When she pulled away, she was laughing. "I've wanted to do that for the longest time." "And?" I asked, more than slightly surprised at what had just happened.
"Now I've done it, Alex."
"Interesting."
"Interesting?"
"I have to go. I have to run." Laughing to herself, Kayla ran out to her van. "Interesting."
Chapter 92.
After some much-needed R&R, I went back to work and found that I was still assigned to the extortion terrorism case, which apparently now involved chasing down whoever was responsible, whoever had the money. I was told that I was picked because I'm relentless. In a way, I was glad it wasn't over. I was still in touch with several of my contacts on the case, Martin Lodge in England, Sandy Greenberg with Interpol, Etienne Marteau in Paris, but also police and intelligence in Tel Aviv and Frankfurt. Everybody I talked to had possible leads, but no one had anything hot, or even what I would consider lukewarm. The Wolf, or maybe Al-Qaeda, or some other clever homicidal bastards, were out there with close to $2 billion in their coffers. Among other things, three city blocks in Paris had been destroyed. Political prisoners had been released. There had to be some slip-up, some way to find them, or at least some way to discover who they were. My second day back, the analyst Monty Donnelly and I made a paper connection that interested me enough to drive all the way out to Lexington, Virginia. I arrived at a two-story contemporary on a back road called Red Hawk Lane. A Dodge Durango was parked in the driveway. A couple of horses grazed in a nearby paddock. Joe Cahill met me at the door of the house. The former CIA agent was all smiles, just as I remembered him from past meetings about the Wolf. Joe had told me over the phone that he was eager to help the investigation in any way he could. He invited me inside and had coffee and a store-bought crumb cake waiting in his den. The room had views of an outlying pasture, a pond, and the Blue Ridge Mountains off in the distance.
"I guess you can tell I missed the job. Some days anyway. You can only do so much hunting and fishing. You fish, Alex? You hunt?"
"I've taken the kids fishing a couple of times," I said. "I hunt some, yeah. Right now, I'm hoping to bag the Wolf. I need your help, though, Joe. I want to go over some old ground. Something has come up."
Chapter 93. "All right, you want to talk about him again? How we got the Wolf out of Russia, what happened once he arrived in America, how he disappeared after that. It's a sad but well-known and documented story, Alex. You've seen the files. I know you have. Almost ended my career."
"Joe, I don't understand why nobody seems to know who he is, what he looks like, his real name. That's the story I've been getting for over a year now, but how can it be? How could we work with England to extricate an important KGB guy and not know who he is? Something bad happened in Paris, but nobody knows what. How is it possible? What am I missing? What has everybody missed so far?" Joe Cahill spread his large working man hands, palms up.
"Look, I obviously don't have all the pieces either. It's my understanding that he was undercover when he was inside Russia. Supposedly, he was a young, very cagey agent, which would mean he's still only in his early 40s. But I've also read reports that he's in his late 50s or 60s now, that he was actually pretty high up in the KGB when he defected. I've also heard that the Wolf is female. I think he spreads the rumors himself. I'm almost certain that's what he does.
Joe, you and your old partner were his controls once he got here.
Our boss was Tom Weir, who wasn't the director yet. Actually, the team included three other guys, Maddock, Boykin, and Graebner. Maybe you should talk to them.
Cahill rose from his easy chair. He went and opened French doors leading out to a stone patio. A cooling breeze swept into the room.
I never met him, Alex. Neither did my partner, Corky Hancock, or the rest of the team, Jay, Sam, Clark. That's the way it was set up from the beginning. It was the deal he brokered when he came out of Russia. He'd help us bring down the old KGB, name names there and here in the U.S., but nobody got to see him. Believe me, he delivered names and information that helped bring down the evil empire.
I nodded. Right. He keeps his promises. But now he's on the loose, and he's established his own crime network, and a whole lot more. Cahill took a bite of his coffee cake, then talked with his mouth full.
Apparently, that's exactly what he did. Of course, we had no idea that he would go bad. Neither did the Brits. Maybe Tom Weir did. I don't know.
I needed some air. I got up and walked to the open doors. A couple of horses were hugging a white wooden fence under the shade of oak trees. I turned to face Joe Cahill. Okay, so you can't help me with the wolf. What can you help me with, Joe? Cahill frowned and looked confused.
I'm sorry, Alex. Not much. I'm an old plow horse, not good for much of anything anymore. Coffee cake's good, right?
I shook my head. Not really, Joe. Trust me. Store-bought's never the same. Cahill's face sagged. Then he grinned, but his eyes weren't smiling.
So now we're going to be honest, I guess. Why the hell are you here? What's this about? Talk to Uncle Joe. What's going on? I'm kind of lost. You're playing way over my head.
I stepped back into the room. Oh, it's all about the wolf, Joe. See, I think you and your old partner can help us a lot. Even if you never met him in person, and I'm not so sure that you didn't. Cahill finally threw up his hands in frustration.
Alex, this is a little crazy, you know. I feel like we're running around in circles. I'm too old and ornery for this shit.
Yeah, well, it's been a tough couple of weeks for everybody. A lot of craziness going around. You don't know the half of it. But I'd had enough of Uncle Joe Cahill's crap. I showed him a photograph. Take a good look. This is the woman who murdered CIA Director Weir at the Hoover Building. Cahill shook his head.
Okay. So?
Her name is Nikki Williams, and she's former Army. She operated as a mercenary for a while. A sniper. A good one. Lots of private contracts on her resume. I know what you're going to say, Joe. So?
Yeah. So?
Once upon a time, she worked for you and your partner, Hancock. Your agency shared your files with us, Joe. New era of cooperation. Here's the real twist. I think you hired her to kill Weir. Maybe you did it through Jeffrey Schaefer, but you were involved. I think you work for the Wolf. Maybe you always have. Maybe that was part of his deal, too.
You're crazy, and you're dead wrong.
Joe Cahill stood up and brushed crumbs from his trousers.
You know what else? I think you better leave now. I'm sorry as hell I invited you into my house. This little talk of ours is over.
No, Joe. Actually, it's just getting started. Chapter 94. I made a call on my cell phone. Minutes later, agents from Langley and Quantico swarmed onto the property and arrested Joe Cahill. They cuffed him and dragged him out of his nice, peaceful house in the country. We had a lead now. Maybe a good one. Joe Cahill was transported to a CIA safe house somewhere in the Alleghenies. The grounds and the home looked ordinary enough. A two-story fieldstone farmhouse surrounded by grapevines and fruit trees, the entryway thick with wisteria. But this wasn't going to be a safe house for Uncle Joe. The former agent was bound and gagged, then left alone in a small room for several hours to think about his future and his past. A CIA doctor arrived. A tall, paunchy man who looked to be in his late 30s, horsey, waspish. His name was Jay O'Connell. He told us that an experimental truth serum had been approved for use on Cahill. O'Connell explained that variations of the drug were currently being used on terrorist prisoners at various prisons. "It's a barbiturate, like sodium amytal and Brevetol," he said. "All of a sudden, the subject will feel slightly drunk, diminished senses. After that, he won't be able to defend himself very well against prodding questions. At least, we hope not. Subjects can react differently. We'll see with this guy. He's older, so I'm fairly confident we'll nail him." "What's the worst we can expect?" I asked O'Connell. "That'd be cardiac arrest." "Oh, hell, it's a joke." "Well, actually, I guess it isn't." It was early in the morning when Joe Cahill was moved out of the small holding room and brought into a larger one in the cellar, with no windows. His blindfold and gag were removed, but not the binds around his wrists. We sat him in a straight-backed chair. Cahill blinked his eyes repeatedly before he could tell where he was and who else was in the room with him.
"Disorientation techniques won't work worth a crap on me. This is really dumb. Nonsense. It's horseshit."
"Yes, we think so too," said Dr. O'Connell. He turned to one of the agents, Larry LaDove. "Roll up his sleeve for me anyway. There we go. This will pinch. Then it'll sting. Then you'll spill out your guts to us."
Chapter 95.
For the next 3.5 hours, Cahill continued to slur his words badly and to act like a man who'd had a half dozen drinks or more in him and was ready for more.
"I know what you guys are doing,"
Uncle Joe said, and shook a finger at the three of us in the room with him. "We know what you're doing, too," said the CIA guy, LaDove, "and what you've done."
"Haven't done anything. Innocent until proven guilty. Besides, if you know so much, why are we talking?"
"Joe, where is the wolf?" I asked him. "What country? Give us something."
"Don't know,"
Cahill said, then laughed as if something he'd said was funny.
"All these years, I don't know. I don't."
"But you've met him?" I said.
"Never seen them. Not once. Not even in the beginning. Very smart, clever. Paranoid, maybe. Doesn't miss a trick, though. Interpol might have seen him during the transport. Tom Weir? The Brits, maybe. Had him for a while before we got him."
"We'd already checked with London, but they had nothing substantial about the defection. And there was nothing about a mistake in Paris. How long have you been working with him?" I asked Cahill. He looked for an answer on the ceiling.
"Working for him, you mean?"
"Yes. How long?"
"Long time. Sold out early in the game. Jesus, long time ago."
Cahill started to laugh again.
"A lot of us did. CIA, FBI, DEA. So he claims. I believe him."
I said, "He gave you orders to have Thomas Weir killed. You already told us that." Which he hadn't.
"Okay. If I did, I did. Whatever the hell you say."
"Why did he want Thomas Weir killed? Why Weir? What happened between them?"
"No, it doesn't work that way. You just get your job. You never see the whole plan. But there was something between him and Weir. Bad blood. Anyway, he sure as hell never contacted me. Always my partner. Always Hancock. He's the one who got the wolf out of Russia. Corky, the Germans, the Brits. I told you that, right?"
Cahill winked at us.
"This stuff is good. Truth serum. Drink the grape juice, boys."
He looked over at O'Connell.
"You too, Dr. Mengele. Drink the fucking grape and the truth will set you free."
Chapter 96. Had we gotten the truth out of Joe Cahill? Was there anything to his drug-induced ramblings? Corky Hancock? The Germans? The Brits? Thomas Weir? Somebody had to know something about the Wolf. Where he was, who he was, what he might be up to next. So I was on the road again, tracking down the Wolf. Joe Cahill's partner had moved out to the central Idaho Rockies after he had taken early retirement. He lived on the outskirts of Haley in the Wood River Valley, about a dozen miles south of Sun Valley. Not a bad life for a former spook. As we drove from the airport to Haley, we passed through what the Bureau driver described as high desert. Hancock, like Joe Cahill, was a hunter and fisherman, it seemed. Silver Creek Preserve, a world-famous catch-and-release fishing area, was nearby. "We're not going to bust in on Hancock. We'll keep him under surveillance, try to see what he's up to. He's off in the mountains hunting right now. We'll run by his place, let you have a look," said the local senior agent, a young Turk named Ned Rust. "Hancock is an expert shot with a rifle, by the way. Thought I'd mention that." We drove up into the hills, where several of the larger houses seemed to be on 5 to 10 acre lots. Some homes had well-manicured lawns, which looked unnaturally green in contrast to the ashen hills, which, of course, were natural. "There have been avalanches in the area recently," Rust said as we drove. He was just chock full of information. "Might see some wild horses. Or Bruce Willis. Demi and Ashton and the kids. Anyway, there's Hancock's house up ahead. Exterior's River Rock. Popular around here. Lot of house for a retired agent with no family." "He's probably got some money to spend on himself," I said. The house was large, all right, and handsome, with spectacular views in three directions. There was a detached barn that was bigger than my house, and a couple of horses grazing nearby. No Corky Hancock, though. He was off hunting. Well, so was I. Nothing much happened in Haley for the next few days. I was briefed by the senior agent in charge, a man named William Koch. The CIA had also sent a heavy from Washington, Bridget Rooney. Hancock returned from his hunting outing, and we watched his every move. Static surveillance was set up by an operations group that had been flown in from Quantico. There was a mobile team whenever Hancock left the house. We were taking him very seriously. After all, the Wolf was out there somewhere with close to $2 billion in winnings. But maybe we finally had a way to track him. The CIA agent who brought him out of Russia. And maybe it was all connected to whatever had happened between the Wolf and Thomas Weir. The mistake in Paris.
Chapter 97.
It just wasn't going to happen overnight, or the next night, or the one after that. On Friday, I got permission to take a trip out to Seattle to visit my boy. I called Christine, who said that it would be fine, and that Alex would be happy to see me. And so would she. I'd noticed the edge was gone from Christine's voice when we talked these days. Sometimes I could even remember how it had been between us. I wasn't sure that was a good thing, though. I arrived at her house in the late morning and was struck again by what a warm and charming place it was. The house and the yard were very Christine, cozy and light, with the familiar white picket fence and matching handrails hugging the stone steps leading to the front door. Rosemary, thyme, and mint filled the herb garden. Everything just so. Christine answered the bell herself, with Alex in her arms. As much as I tried not to, I couldn't help thinking about the way things might have been if I hadn't been a homicide cop and my life as a detective hadn't violently derailed the two of us. I was surprised that she was home, and she must have recognized the look in my eyes. "I won't bite you, Alex, I promise. I brought Alex back from preschool to be with you," she said. Then she handed over the boy, and He was all I wanted to think about right then.
"Hello, Dada," he said,
and laughed shyly, which is his way at first. I smiled back. A woman I know in the D.C. area calls me a saint, and she doesn't mean it as a compliment. I'm not even close, but I have learned to make the best of things. My guess is that she hasn't.
"You're such a big boy," I said, expressing my surprise and, I suppose, my pride and delight in my son. "How old are you now?
6? 8? 12 years old?" I asked.
"I'm 2, almost 3, he said, and laughed at my joke. He always gets me. At least he seems to. "He's been talking about seeing you all morning, Alex. He kept saying, 'Today's Daddy Day,'" Christine said. "You two have fun together." Then she did something that surprised me. She leaned in and kissed my cheek. That kind of threw me. I may be cautious, even a little paranoid, but I'm not immune. First Kayla Coles, and now Christine. Maybe I looked as though I needed a little TLC. That was probably it. Well, Alex and I did have some good times together. I acted as if Seattle were our hometown, and I went with it. First, we rode over to the Fremont area, where I had visited a retired detective friend a few years back. Fremont was full of older buildings, lots of vintage clothing and furniture shops. Character, if such a worthy trait can actually be traced to architecture and style. A lot of people seem to think it can, but I'm not so sure. When we got there, little Alex and I shared a scone with butter and blackberry jam from the Touchstone Bakery. We continued on our walking tour and closely examined the 55-foot-tall Fremont Rocket attached to one of the local stores. Then I bought Alex a tie-dyed kite, and we took it for a test flight at Gas Works Park, which had a view of Lake Union and downtown Seattle. Seattle has parks galore. It's one of the things I like so much about the city. I wondered if I could ever live out here and imagined that I could. And then I wondered why I was entertaining that line of thought at all. Because Christine had given me a little peck on the cheek? Was I that starved for affection? Pitiful. We did some exploring and checked out the sculpture garden and the Fremont Troll, a large sculpture that reminded me of the singer Joe Cocker clutching a Volkswagen Bug in one hand. Finally, we had a late lunch. Organic, of course. A roasted vegetable salad, plus peanut butter and jelly on Ezekiel bread. When in Rome and all that. "Life is pretty good out here, huh, buddy?" I said as we munched our food together. "This is the best, little guy." Alex Jr. nodded that it was good, but then he stared up at me all wide-eyed and innocent and asked, "When are you coming home, Daddy?" Oh, man, oh, man. When am I coming home?
Chapter 98.
Chapter 98. Christine had asked that I have Alex home before 6, and I did as I'd promised. I am so responsible, so Alex, it drives me a little crazy sometimes. She was waiting for us on the porch in a bright blue dress and heels and handled everything as well as I could have expected her to. She smiled warmly when she saw us and hugged Alex against her long legs when he ran up to her squealing, "Mommy!" "You two look like you had some fun," she said, as she stroked the top of the big boy's head. "That's nice. I knew you would. Alex, Daddy has to go to his house now. Back to Washington, D.C. You and I have to go to Theo's for dinner." Tears filled his eyes.
"I don't want Daddy to go."
"I know, but he has to, sweetheart. Daddy has to go to work. Give him a hug. He'll come visit again." "I will. Of course I will," I said, wondering who Theo was. "I'll always come see you." Alex ran into my arms, and I loved having him close and didn't want to let him go. I loved the smell of him, his touch, the feeling of his little heart beating. But I also didn't want him to feel the separation that was already making my heart ache. "I'll be back real soon," I said.
soon as I can. Don't get too big when I'm not looking. And Alex whispered, "Please don't go away, Daddy. Please don't go." He kept repeating it over and over until I was inside my rental car and driving away, waving back to my son, who kept getting smaller and smaller until he disappeared as I turned the corner of his street. I could still feel Alex's little body pressing against mine. I can still feel it now. Chapter 99. A little before 8 that night, I sat alone at the dimly lit bar inside the Kingfish Cafe on 19th and Mercer in Seattle. I was lost in thoughts about my youngest son. All of my children, really. When Jamila rolled into the restaurant. She had on a long black leather car coat with a dark blouse and black skirt, and she smiled brilliantly when she saw me sitting there at the bar, maybe looking as good to her as she did to me. Maybe. The thing about Jamila is that she's pretty but doesn't seem to know it, at least to believe it. I had mentioned I was coming to Seattle, and Jam said she'd fly up to have dinner with me. At first, I hadn't been sure it was a good idea, but that was wrong. All wrong. I was incredibly happy to see her, especially after leaving Alex. "You look good, sugar," she whispered against my cheek. "But you do seem a little beat up, darling. You're working too hard, burning the candle down." "I feel a lot better right now," I told her. "You look good enough for both of us." "I do? Well, thank you for saying that. Believe me, I needed to hear it." The Kingfish, as it turned out, was a totally democratic restaurant. No reservations, but we were seated quickly at a nice table along the wall. We ordered drinks and food, but mostly we were there to hold hands and talk about everything that was going on in our lives. "This thing with little Alex," I told Jamila about midway through the dinner, "it's the worst torture for me. Goes against who I am, everything I learned from Nana. I can't stand to leave him here." Jamila frowned and seemed angry.
"Doesn't she treat him well?"
"Oh, no, no. Christine is a good mother. It's the separation that kills me. I love that little boy, and I miss him so much every day I'm away from him. I miss the way he talks, walks, thinks, tells bad jokes, listens to mine. We're pals, Jam." "And so," Jamila said, holding my eyes with hers, "you escape into your work." "And so," I nodded, "I do. But that's a whole nother story. Hey, let's get out of here."
"What do you have in mind, Agent Cross?"
"Nothing illegal, Inspector Hughes."
"Hmm, really? Well, that's a shame."
Chapter 100. You've heard the saying, get a room? Well, I already had one at the Fairmont Olympic on University across from Rainier Square, and I couldn't wait to get there. Neither of us could. Jamila whistled under her breath as we walked into the impressive lobby. She stared up at the engraved ceiling, which must have been 40 feet high. There was an actual hush inside the large, over-decorated room at a little past 10 when we arrived.
"Italian Renaissance decor? Big old antique chandeliers? 5 stars? 5 diamonds? I'm wonderfully impressed," Jam said, grinning. As always, her enthusiasm was exhilarating.
"Every once in a while, you just have to build in a treat, you know."
"This is definitely a treat, Alex," Jamila said, and gave me a quick kiss in the lobby. "I'm really happy you're here, and that I'm here too. I like us a lot."
It kept getting better from there. Our room was on the 10th floor, and it was everything it needed to be. Bright, airy, plush, with a king-size bed. We even had a view of Elliott Bay with Bainbridge Island in the distance, and a ferry just leaving the waterfront in the foreground.
The sights and scenes couldn't have been any better if I'd planned them out in elaborate detail, which maybe, just maybe, I had. About that king-size bed at the Fairmont Olympic, it was covered with a gold and green-striped comforter. A duvet? I'm always slightly confused about what distinguishes the two. We didn't bother to remove the comforter slash duvet. We just fell onto it, laughing and talking, happy to be there together, realizing how much we'd missed each other. "Let me make you a little more comfortable, Alex," Jam whispered as she pulled my shirt out of my pants. "How's that? Better?" "And I'll do the same for you." "Only fair," I said to her. "Tit for tat." "Well, yes, I do like that tat of yours." I began to unbutton Jamila's blouse, and she continued unbuttoning my shirt. Neither of us was in a hurry. We knew better than to rush any of this. The whole idea was to make it last, to pay attention to each detail, each button, the feel of the fabric, the tiny bumps of anticipation on Jamila's skin and on mine, the difficulty catching our breath, the tingle in our bodies, the electricity, sparks, whatever goodness came our way that night. "You've been practicing," she whispered, and she was already a little short of breath. I like that. I laughed. "Uh-uh. Actually, I've been practicing the art of anticipation." "Like this next button?" she asked. "Beautiful, isn't it? And the one after that?" "I don't know how much more of this I can take, Jamila. I'm not kidding." "We'll have to see. We'll just have to see. I'm not kidding either." When Jamila's blouse and my shirt were undone, we slowly pulled them off. Meanwhile, we kept kissing, tickling, scratching, nuzzling, ever so slowly. She was wearing perfume, and I recognized it as Kalesh Eau Delicate. She knew I liked the scent. Jamila loved a light scratch all over her body, so that's what I did next. First the shoulders and back, then her arms, her beautiful face, her long legs, her feet, then back up her legs again. "You're getting warm." "Warmer," she sighed, and laughed very deep in her throat. Then we slid back off the bed and stood together, swaying and touching. Finally, I took off her bra and held her breasts in my hands. Like I said, I don't know how much more of this I can take. I didn't either. I was hard, so hard that it hurt. I slid down and knelt on the oriental rug. I kissed Jamila down there. She was strong and confident, and maybe that's why I liked kneeling before her like this. In awe? Out of respect? Something like that. Finally, I pushed myself up again. "Okay," I whispered. "Okay. Whatever you say, I'm your slave. Your master? A little of each?" I went inside Jamila while we were still standing, dancing in place, but then we tilted down and dropped onto the bed. I was lost in the moment, lost in Jamila Hughes, and that was exactly where I needed to be. She was making these tiny sighs and gasps that I loved. "I missed being with you," I whispered. "I missed your smile, the sound of your voice, everything." "Ditto," she said, and laughed. "But especially that tat of yours." Moments later, 5, maybe 10 minutes, the phone on the nightstand began to ring. For once, I did the right thing. I knocked the damn thing onto the floor, then covered it with a pillow. If it was the wolf, he could call back in the morning. Chapter 101. The next morning, I headed back to the Idaho Rockies. Jamila and I shared a cab out to the airport, then took separate planes going in different directions. "Big mistake. Dumb move," she told me before we parted. "You should just fly to San Francisco with me. You need some extended R&R.
I already knew that. But it wasn't going to be. Corky Hancock was the biggest lead we had, and the surveillance on him had been tightening. There was nowhere Hancock could go in the state of Idaho and not be watched, or at least listened to. There was surveillance on his house, the surrounding acreage, even the standalone barn. We had 4 mobile teams on him, with 4 more in the wings if needed. Since I'd left, aerial surveillance had been added to the mix. In Idaho, I attended a meeting of more than 2 dozen agents assigned to the detail. The meeting was held in a small movie house in Sun Valley. The movie 21 Grams with Sean Penn and Naomi Watts was playing there in the evenings, but not during the day. Senior Agent William Koch stood in front of us. Tall and gangly, impressive in his way, he wore a chambray shirt, jeans, scuffed black cowboy boots. He played the local guide to a T, but he was nobody's fool, and he wanted us to know it. The same was true for his CIA counterpart, Bridget Rooney, a confident, dark-haired woman who was smarter than a whip. I'll make this pretty simple for everybody. Either Hancock knows we're here or he's just unbelievably careful by nature, said Koch. He hasn't talked to anybody since we got here. He's been online. eBay for fishing rods, a couple of porn sites, a fantasy baseball league. He has a girlfriend named Coral Lee, who lives nearby in Ketchum. Asian-American girl. Coral is definitely a good looker. Corky isn't. We figured he probably spends lots of money on her, and it turns out he does. Slightly less than $200,000 so far this year. Trips, jewelry, one of those cute little Lexus convertibles the gals like. Koch paused and looked around the room. That's about it, except we know that Hancock is connected to the Wolf and that he's been paid a lot of money for his services. So at 1,200 hours, we're going in to take a look for ourselves inside the house. Somebody patted me on the shoulder as though I had something to do with the decision that must have come down from Washington. Not me. I turned and shrugged at the agent congratulating me. I'm just a soldier here. The team going inside Hancock's place was mostly FBI, but there was a handful of CIA agents too, led by Rooney. The CIA was in Idaho as a courtesy, partly because of the new working relationship that existed between the two agencies, but mostly because Hancock was directly involved in the murder of Thomas Weir, one of theirs. But I doubted they wanted to take Hancock down any more than I did. I wanted the Wolf, and somehow, somewhere, I was going to get him. At least, that was what I needed to think. Chapter 102. Koch and Rooney were in charge, and they finally gave us the go. At the appointed hour, we swarmed all over the Hancock house. FBI emblazoned shirts and windbreakers were everywhere. Probably scared off a few deer and jackrabbits, even though not a single shot was fired. Hancock was in bed with his girlfriend. He was 64 years old. Coral was supposed to be 26. Lustrous black hair, good figure, lots and lots of rings and things, slept in the nude on her back. Hancock at least had the decency to wear a Utah Jazz sweatshirt and sleep in a fetal position. He began to shout at us, which was actually kind of ironic and funny.
What the hell is this shit? Get out of my damn house!
But he forgot to look surprised, or he just wasn't a good actor. Either way, I get the feeling that he knew we were coming. How? Because he'd spotted us over the past few days? Or had Hancock been warned by someone in one of the cooperating agencies? Did the Wolf know we were on to Hancock? During the first couple of hours of interviews, we tried Dr. O'Connell's truth serum on Hancock. It didn't work as well on him as it had with Joe Cahill. He got happy and high, but he just sat back and went with it. Didn't tell us much, wouldn't even confirm things that Cahill had already confessed. Meanwhile, a search of the house, barn, and 60 acres of grounds was going on. Hancock owned an Aston Martin convertible, and the Wolf loved fast cars, but nothing else even vaguely suspicious turned up. Not for 3 whole days,
during which nearly 100 agents combed every square inch of the ranch. During that time, half a dozen computer experts, including loaners from Intel and IBM, tried to break into Hancock's two computers. They finally concluded that he'd had experts put up extra security to protect whatever was inside. There was nothing to do but wait around some more. I read every magazine and newspaper in Hancock's house, including several back issues of the Idaho Mountain Express. I went for long walks and tried to figure out a direction for my life that made some sense to me. I didn't do real well, but the fresh mountain air was a nice treat for my lungs. When a computer breakthrough finally came, there wasn't much to go on. No direct link to the wolf or to anyone else who seemed suspicious to us. At least not at first. The next day, though, a hacker from our offices in Austin, Texas, found a file inside an encrypted file. It contained regular communication with a bank in Zurich. Actually, with a couple of banks in Switzerland. And suddenly we didn't just suspect. We knew that Hancock had a lot of money. Over $6 million, at least that much. Which was the best news we'd had in a long while. So off to Zurich we went, at least for a day or two. I didn't expect to find the wolf there, but you never know. And I'd never been to Switzerland. Janny begged me to bring back chocolate, a suitcase full of the stuff, and I promised I would. A whole suitcase full of Swiss chocolate, sweetheart. Least I can do for missing most of your 9th year. Chapter 103. If I were the wolf, this would be a good place to live. Zurich is a beautiful, amazingly clean city on the lake, the Zurichsee, with lovely fragrant shade trees and wide winding sidewalks along the water and fresh mountain air meant to be breathed in deeply. When I arrived, a storm was imminent and the air smelled like brass. The exterior of a majority of the buildings were in light shades, sand and white, and several were adorned with Swiss flags twisting in the blustery wind off the lake. As I drove into the city, I noticed trolley tracks everywhere with heavy-looking wires hanging overhead. The power of the old. Also, several life-size fiberglass cows painted with alpine scenes which reminded me of little Alex's favorite toy, Moo. What was I going to do about Alex? What could I do? The Zurich Bank was a 60s-looking building, glass and steel front, situated very close to the lake. Sandy Greenberg met me outside. She was wearing a gray suit, had a black handbag slung over her shoulder, and looked as though maybe she worked inside the bank instead of for Interpol. "You ever been to Zurich, Alex?" Sandy asked as she gave me a hug and kiss on both cheeks. "Never. Had one of their multi-purpose knives once when I was 10 or 11. "Alex, we have to eat a meal here. Promise me. Let's go inside now. They're waiting for us and they don't like to wait in Zurich, especially the bankers." The inside of the Zurich bank was expensive looking, highly polished, wood paneling everywhere, as spotless as a hospital operating room. The teller area was natural stone with more wood paneling. The tellers were efficient and professional looking, and they whispered to one another. The bank's branding was understated, but there was a great deal of modern art on the wall. I thought that I understood. The art was the bank's branding. "Zurich has always been a haven for avant-garde intellectuals, cultured types," Sandy said, and didn't whisper. "The Dada movement was born here. Wagner, Strauss, Jung all lived here." "James Joyce wrote Ulysses in Zurich," I said, and winked at her. Sandy laughed. "I forgot. You're a closet intellectual." We were escorted to the bank president's office, which had a serious look. Neat as a pin, too. Only one transaction on the desk blotter. Everything else filed away. Sandy handed Mr. Delmar Pomeroy an envelope. "A signed warrant," she said. "The account number is 616-479Q.
"Everything has been promptly arranged,"
Herr Pomeroy said to us. That was all. Then his warrant officer took us to look at the transactions in and out of account number 616479Q. So much for the secrecy and security of Swiss banks. Everything has been promptly arranged.
Chapter 104.
This was feeling more like an efficient, orderly police investigation now, even though I knew it really wasn't. Sandy, two of her agents from Interpol, and I got to look through all of Corky Hancock's transactions in a small, windowless room somewhere deep in the basement of the Zurich Bank. The former CIA agent's account had grown from $200,000 to slightly over $6 million. Yowza. The latest and largest deposits totaled $3.5 million and had come in 4 installments this year. The source of the payment was an account in the name of Y. Yikimirov. It took us a couple of hours to track down all of the records. There were more than 100 pages going all the way back to 91, the year the wolf had been brought out of Russia. Coincidence? I didn't believe in them. Not anymore. We carefully examined withdrawals from the Yikimirov account. They included payments to a company that leased private jets, regular air travel with British Airways and Air France, hotels, Claridge's, the Bel Air in L.A., the Sherry Netherland in New York, the Four Seasons in Chicago and Maui. There were wire transfers to America, South Africa, Australia, Paris, Tel Aviv. The trail of a wolf. And an entry that particularly caught my interest. The purchase of 4 expensive sports cars in France, all from a dealership in Nice, Riviera Motors. A Lotus, a special edition Jaguar, and 2 Aston Martins. The wolf is supposed to be a sports car enthusiast, I said to Sandy. Maybe the cars mean something. Maybe we're closer than we suspect. What do you think? She nodded agreement. Yes. I think we should visit Riviera Motors in Nice. Nice is nice. But first, Alex, lunch in Zurich. I made you a promise. No, I think you made me promise. After my bad Swiss Army knife joke. I was hungry anyway, so it seemed a good idea. Sandy chose the Veterinär Keller, one of her favorites, a restaurant she thought I would appreciate. As we entered, she explained that Veterinär Keller had been a restaurant since 1551, a long time for any business to survive. So we forgot about police work for an hour and a half. We dined on barley soup, Zuppa in Gadnese, a casserole, Veterinär Topf, and very good wine. Everything was just so. Crisp white linens and napkins, roses and sterling vases, crystal salt and pepper shakers. This is one of your better ideas, I told Sandy near the end of the meal. A nice break in the action. It's called lunch, Alex. You have to try it more. You should come to Europe with your friend Jamila. You're working too hard. It shows, I guess. No, actually, you look as good as ever. You're holding up better than Denzel. In his latest movies, anyway. Somehow you persevere. I don't know how, but you do. But I can tell that you're twisted up inside. Eat, relax. Then we'll go to Nice and check out some sports cars. It will be like a holiday. Maybe we'll even catch a killer. Finish your wine, Alex. Right, I said. And then I have to buy some chocolate for Jenny. A suitcase full. I made another promise. Didn't you promise to catch the wolf? Sandy asked. Yeah, that too.
Chapter 105.
Next stop, a luxury car dealership in Nice. I felt as if I were in an Alfred Hitchcock movie. The owner of Riviera Motors, the concessionnaire exclusif Jaguar, Aston Martin, Lotus,
appeared to like drama, too, at least in a design sense. To that effect, a long row of gleaming black cars was displayed in the showroom. The cars were clearly visible from the street through monumental bay windows. The shiny black machines cut a startling contrast to a spotless white floor. "What do you think?" Sandy asked as we climbed out of our rented Peugeot, which we had parked across the street from the dealership. "I think I need a new car," I said to her. "And I know the Wolf likes fancy sports cars." We went inside and stopped at the reception desk in front. Behind it was an elegant reception person, well-tanned with a bleached and ironed ponytail. She was checking Sandy and me out. Both over 6 feet, ebony and ivory. Who are these people? "We are here to see Monsieur Gagné," Sandy said to the woman in French.
"You have an appointment with Monsieur, madame?"
"We do indeed. Interpol and the FBI, respectively. And respectfully, I might add. Monsieur Gagné is expecting us, I believe. We are here on important business." While we waited, I continued to take in the place. The expensive cars were precisely parked in a herringbone pattern, interspersed with voluminous potted plants. In an adjacent service atelier, mechanics in matching Jaguar green jumpsuits worked with pristine tools. The manager of the car dealership appeared after a couple of minutes' wait. He was dressed in a fashionable gray suit, but not too flashy, just clearly expensive and right.
You've come about a couple of Aston Martins? A Jaguar? A Lotus?
"Something like that, monsieur," Sandy told him. "Let's go up to your office. We wouldn't want to hurt business by talking down here in the showroom." The manager smiled.
"Oh, believe me, madame, our business is bulletproof."
"We'll see about that," I told him in French. "Or maybe a better way of putting it, let's try and keep it that way. This is a murder investigation." Chapter 106. The manager suddenly became extremely polite and cooperative. The four luxury cars in question had been purchased by an Monsieur Aglianby, who apparently had a home nearby on the beautiful peninsula, Cap Ferrat, just east of Nice. Monsieur Garnier told us it was
off the Basque Corniche, the main coastal road to Monaco. You can't miss it, and you won't miss the Aglianby estate.
"To catch a thief," Sandy said as we sped along toward Cap Ferrat about 2 hours later. We had lost a little time calling in backup.
"Actually, the most memorable shots in the Hitchcock movie were filmed up there," Sandy went on.
She pointed toward a parallel road winding along the cliffs. It was at least 100 yards higher than the one we were driving on. In other words, very high up and dangerous looking. "Also, we're here to catch a mass murderer without any conscience," I said. "Not a witty and charming cat burglar like Cary Grant was in the flick."
"That is true, too. Keep me focused, Alex. I could easily get distracted here," Sandy said.
But I knew she was focused, always. That's why we got along so well. The Aglianby estate was located on the west side of Cap Ferrat, in Villefranche-sur-Mer. There were glimpses of villas and gardens hidden behind high stucco and rock walls as we rode along D-125, also known as Boulevard Circulaire. Half a dozen cars and vans followed us, also catching the sights, no doubt. A shiny blue Rolls-Royce convertible easing out of one of the estates with a blonde in sunglasses and kerchief behind the wheel. Dark-glassed tourists catching rays on the terrace of the Grand Hôtel du Cap Ferrat. A bathing pool dug into solid rock at Piscine de Son Beach.
"You think this is a fool's errand, Alex?" Sandy asked.
"It's what we do. Hit and miss, hunt and peck. I feel good about this one. It has to be something. Monsieur Aglianby has to be connected somehow." I was hopeful. We had found an awful lot of money in the account of Corky Hancock, and most of it had come in recently. But how much did he really know about the Wolf? How much did anyone know?
Then we saw the estate we were looking for, and Sandy drove past.
"Got you, you bastard," she said. "Aglionby? The wolf? Why not?"
"Whoever lives back there is certainly loaded. Jesus, how much is enough?"
"When you have $1 billion or so, this is rather modest, Alex. It's not a question of a house. It's houses. The Riviera, London, Paris, Aspen."
"If you say so. I've never had $1 billion myself, or a villa on the Riviera." The place in question was a sun-drenched Mediterranean-style mansion, creamy yellow with white detailing. It had gleaming balustrades and porticos, shutters that the staff apparently closed to the midday sun. Or maybe the people inside just didn't want to be seen. 4 stories, 30-plus rooms, as cozy as Versailles. But for now, all we were interested in was a peek. As we had planned earlier, we reconnoitered at a small hotel just up the coast. The decision was made by local police officials to use the estate bordering the Aglionby place on the south side. It was vacant now, except for a large staff. We would dress and pose as gardeners and household help, starting tomorrow morning. Sandy and I listened to the plan as it was laid out, step by step. We looked at each other, shook our heads. "Not this time." I spoke. "We're going in tonight," I announced, "with or without your help."
Chapter 107.
The decision to go right away was backed enthusiastically by Interpol and even by the French in Paris, who were in close contact with Washington and wanted the murderous wolf as badly as the rest of the world did. Maybe more. For a change, everything happened very quickly that afternoon and through the early evening. I was going to be part of the assault, and so was Sandy. The attack was planned as if the wolf was definitely inside the villa. 7 two-person teams of snipers were deployed on all sides of the estate, which were designated as white, north, red, east, black, south, and green, west. Every door and window was covered, and each of the snipers had a specific number of targets. They were closest to the estate. Our eyes and ears. So far, they weren't seeing any sign that we'd been spotted. While the snipers moved into position, the rest of us, Interpol, the FBI, the French Army and police, strapped on war gear, black Nomex flight suits, body armor, handguns, MP5 submachine guns. 3 helicopters were waiting less than a mile away and would be used during the assault. We were ready for the green light, but some of the more jaded among us expected a last-minute delay for politics, cold feet at the command level, something unforeseen to get in the way. I lay flat on the ground on my stomach beside Sandy Greenberg. We were less than 100 yards from the main house. Starting to feel the jitters. At least I was. The wolf could be inside this house. Maybe he was Aglionby. Some lights were on inside, but we seldom saw anyone at the windows past midnight. Security was modest on the grounds, just a couple of guards.
"Awfully quiet," said Sandy. "I don't know if I like this, Alex. Security's light."
"It's almost 2 in the morning.
"You surprised that we're going in?" Sandy asked.
I smiled. "Are we going in?" "No, I'm not surprised. Remember, the French want the wolf, maybe even more than we do." Then the signal came to go. Sandy and I were part of the second assault team, and we ran toward the house about 45 seconds after the first wave. We entered through the back. Black. The kitchen, to be exact. Somebody had switched on the overheads. A guard lay on the floor, his hands cuffed behind his head. Highly polished marble was everywhere, 4 stoves at the center of the room. I noticed a large glass bowl on a table. I took a peek at what looked like dark noses inside. Figs, I finally realized, smiling to myself. Then Sandy and I were running down a long hallway. No gunshots had been fired inside the house yet. Lots of other noise, though. We came to the formal living room of diplomatic proportions. Chandeliers dangled over our head, polished marble floor, half a dozen dark and solemn paintings by French and Dutch masters. No Wolf so far. No sign of him.
"This for entertaining or signing treaties?" Sandy asked me. "Alex, why aren't they fighting back? What's going on? Is he here?"
We climbed a winding staircase and saw French soldiers leading men and women out of the bedrooms. Most were in their underwear. A few were naked. Nobody looked very sexy, but they certainly looked surprised. I didn't see anybody who might be the Wolf, but how could I tell for certain what the Wolf looked like? How could anybody? The interrogations began immediately right there in the hallways. "Where is the Wolf? Who is Aglionby?" The entire house was searched a second time, then a third. Marcel Aglionby wasn't at the house, we were told by several of the guests. He was on business in New York. One of his daughters was present. This was her party, her guests, her friends, though some of them looked to be twice her age. Her father was a respected banker, she swore to us. No way was he a criminal. No way was he the Wolf. So, is he the Wolf's banker? And where does that lead us? I hated to think it.